everyone. My name is Maddie, and I'm coming from Misha Lukin's group at Harvard. And today I'll be talking about my research, which is really looking at quantum algorithms for solving combinatorial optimization problems. And I'll be talking both about experimental work as well as theoretical work that's really looking for some sort of quantum speedup on these problems. And please interrupt me at any point if you have questions. So my research is really motivated by the prospect of demonstrating near-term quantum speedup. And in particular, I'm interested in the devices that we have around today, where we have less than around 1,000 qubits and no error correction. And we're really interested in looking at quantum speedup on useful problems. So going beyond the recent demonstration of quantum advantage by sampling the output of random quantum circuits. And what I really mean by quantum speedup is that the resources needed to solve the problem, whether it be time or memory, scale more favorably for a quantum algorithm than a classical algorithm as a function of the problem hardness. And so, of course, there are many known example algorithms that do this, such as Shor's algorithm for factoring or Grover's database search. But only a few of these algorithms can really be implemented successfully on near-term devices. And so I'll be focusing on one of these problems today, which is combinatorial optimization. So combinatorial optimization problems are, I would say, a really broad set of problems with the goal of optimizing some generic cost function, perhaps over a set of bit strings subject to constraints. These problems are known to be NP-hard, which means that they're intractable to solve for the worst case instances. But they're very general class of problems, so if we could solve one NP-hard problem, we could really solve all NP-hard problems. And many of these problems we see in our everyday life in the context of optimization, so that, for instance, the traveling salesman problem, where we'd like to minimize the total distance traveled, say, between cities, subject to the constraint that our path includes all cities. Today, I'll be focusing on another NP-hard problem called maximum independent set. In this problem, we're given a graph, so a set of nodes connected by edges, and we'd like to maximize the size of a subset of nodes subject to the independent set constraint, which says that no two nodes in the set are connected by an edge. And what we'd really like to find is the maximum independent set, which I show here in red, which is just the largest set of nodes that satisfy this constraint. And the reason I'll be focusing on this problem in particular is that it has a really nice hardware implementation in the platform I'll be looking at today, which is a Rydberg atom array platform, which allows us to really probe this combinatorial optimization problem at relatively large graph sizes. So as I mentioned, I'll be looking at an experimental data from a Rydberg atom array platform today, which was from the group that I'm in. And what we do here is we take several hundred rubidium atoms, each of which is a qubit, and we arrange them deterministically in 2D, and we trap them in optical tweezers so that their location is fixed. And we will have a very hardware-efficient encoding where we basically associate each qubit with a node on the graph that we want to find the maximum independent set of. And in particular, our two qubit states will represent that node being in the independent set. So in the independent set is represented by what we call a Rydberg state. It's a highly excited state that will interact with other atoms in the Rydberg state. And then out of the independent set will be stored in a hyperfine ground state of our atom. And we can address this transition with a laser by driving that laser in a time-varying way. And the way that we'll encode the MIS problem is by using what is called the Rydberg blockade constraint. And this is a local interaction between atoms that are nearby in the Rydberg state. And what it essentially does is within a certain radius, we will have simultaneous excitation to the Rydberg state energetically forbidden. And so we'll use this interaction to define the connectivity of our graph. And in particular, within a characteristically strong radius, we'll say that two atoms or nodes are connected by an edge. And this defines a class of graphs called unit disk graph, where we have an edge between two nodes if they're within some radius. And this Rydberg interaction will really naturally encode the independent set constraint on these graphs, because two atoms in the independent set or in the Rydberg state can't simultaneously be excited. They can't simultaneously be in the independent set. So we'll be testing out a quantum algorithm called the quantum adiabatic algorithm. So here we have our system Hamiltonian, which for us is a driver type Hamiltonian, so a sigma x type term between Brown and Rydberg, as well as a cost function Hamiltonian, which will encode the maximum independent set as its ground state. And the way that we do this is we have a local detuning term that favors having many nodes in the independent set or many atoms in Rydberg, as well as the Rydberg blockade interaction term that will basically penalize independent set violations. And when our detuning delta is positive, the ground state of this Hamiltonian will encode the MIS, the maximum independent set. And we can prepare this ground state adiabatically by initializing the system in some easy to prepare many body ground state, slowly changing our Hamiltonian so that we stay in the instantaneous ground state of our system. And then our final hard to prepare Hamiltonian will encode the MIS as its ground state. So in practice, how we do this is we initialize the atoms in their atomic ground state. We'll sweep our detuning from negative to positive while turning the laser on and off. And if we do this slowly, we will end up in the maximum independent set of our graph, which just maximizes the number of atoms in Rydberg subject to this blockade constraint. And then we use closed loop classical optimization to optimize how we change this detuning as a function of time so that we're getting the best performance out of the quantum device as possible. So as an outline of what I'll talk about today, I'll be really talking about two works. So first, I'll go over the experimental signatures we observed of a possible speedup over a classical algorithm called simulated annealing in solving maximum independent set. And then I'll go into a theoretical mechanism for both the observed experimental performance, which then motivated a new quantum algorithm that guarantees a speedup over simulated annealing on the instances that we look at. So as I mentioned, we'll be benchmarking our quantum algorithm against a classical algorithm called simulated annealing. And the reason that we choose simulated annealing is that, like the adiabatic algorithm, it really just seeks to minimize a generic cost Hamiltonian. And the way that it does this is it'll prepare the Gibbs distribution of our cost Hamiltonian, which, remember, at low temperatures will prepare the ground state, which is just the solution to our problem. And it'll do this by basically stochastically updating a candidate spin configuration that'll represent an independent set. So in practice, what you'll do is you'll propose to update your current independent set to a new independent set, and then you'll accept with some probability that depends on both the temperature that you're annealing at as well as the change in energy induced by that update. Please help me know, by the way, if anyone has questions. So one key thing to notice under this algorithm is that among states with the same energy, so the change in energy in this update probability is zero, the SA dynamics are really a random walk. And that's because there's no kind of gradient in the energy that we can use to tell us how to get to lower energy. And what we empirically find up to system sizes of hundreds of nodes is that the hardest instances for simulated annealing on MIS for unit disk graphs essentially will have exponentially many suboptimal solutions with the same energy that SA will basically randomly walk between, unable to find a better state or a better independent set. And so as an example, let's take an example unit disk graph instance that we might run on the experiment. And we can visualize its energy landscape, so the energy of all our independent sets, on what I call a configuration graph. So here the nodes are actually individual independent sets of this graph. And the light green nodes are the suboptimal independent sets. In this case, they're the MIS size minus one, so one away from optimal. And there are many light green nodes. And then what we'd like to prepare is the dark green independent sets or nodes, which are the MIS states. And notice that there's many such suboptimal independent sets compared to optimal independent sets. And what I'm doing is I'm connecting nodes with an edge if they're connected with a single update of simulated annealing. So what simulated annealing will basically do is it'll randomly walk between these suboptimal states until it just happens upon an optimal solution. we can actually characterize our expected runtime for SA to find the MIS as basically the ratio of suboptimal states to optimal states in this case, which is just the probability of kind of randomly happening upon an MIS. And here I notate it by the ratio of degeneracies of MIS minus one states for this instance and MIS to MIS states, where degeneracy is just, again, the number of independent sets of that size. And it ends up that we can actually analytically lower bound the runtime of any SA algorithm, including, you know, algorithms with cluster updates, as basically the maximum of these degeneracy ratios. Basically kind of the largest bottleneck in SA that comes from these really large, like, barren plateaus in the energy landscape. And I'll define this quantity as what I'll call the SA hardness parameter, because for us it's really controlling SA hardness to find the solution. And so what we do is we generate the top 2% hardest instances, maximizing this SA hardness parameter. And what we find is, as we predicted, our runtime to find the solution is linear in this hardness parameter, which is the best possible provable case for SA. And now what we want to do is then test these exact same instances on our quantum device. So what we find when we run these same instances on the quantum device is that the quantum performance really varies on instances with similar SA hardness parameter. So here I take two graphs with the exact same hardness parameter, and which are notated by kind of the different colors of lines on this plot, and I look at the Hamming distance, so the number of spin flips to get to the MIS. And what we find is that for on the gold instance, the quantum data, which is this dotted line, quickly approaches the solution at a normalized Hamming distance of zero, whereas SA remains stuck in suboptimal solutions for up to very high circuit depths. On the other hand, on this purple instance, there's much more similar performance between SA and the quantum algorithm. And we can summarize this result by plotting the quantum data on the same axis. So here I'm defining quantum runtime as just basically the evolution time divided by the time to flip a single spin, similar to how I define runtime for SA. And what we see is that the quantum data has a really large scatter on this plot, indicating that the quantum runtime is not very well correlated with this SA hardness parameter. So this motivated us to really try to understand what was controlling the performance of this quantum algorithm. So one thing that's known about quantum adiabatic algorithms is that the performance is determined, the likelihood that you can kind of stay in this many-body ground state is determined by the minimum energy gap of your Hamiltonian between the ground and the first excited state. So in practice, this looks like as we, you know, sweep our detuning, we'll have some minimum energy gap, and we really need to kind of stay adiabatic at that point. So to test if we're limited by this minimum energy gap, what we do is we'll basically slow down our evolution at a certain detuning during the run. And we find that if we slow down our detuning at a place that corresponds to this minimum energy gap, we see a large spike in MIS probability, so the probability of finding the true solution. And this indicates that, indeed, when we slow down at this adiabatic gap, we're truly sensitive to staying in the ground state at this point. And we can summarize this by plotting our MIS probability as a function of the minimum energy gap. And we see a really strong correlation between these two quantities, indicating that our experiment really is sensitive to this many-body adiabatic gap. Furthermore, we notice that a few instances have a minimum gap that's so small that we can't really resolve it during our coherence time. And what we found is that when we focused on these instances where we could optimize our adiabatic algorithm and have enough runtime to stay above this gap-limited physics, that we saw a better scaling of runtime with hardness parameter. However, of course, there were some instances that had very small adiabatic gaps, and we really wanted to understand what was going on here and what was really causing the fact that the SA hardness parameter and the quantum performance, i.e. the minimum energy gap, are not well correlated. So this led us to do a follow-up theoretical work where we're really studying what's controlling this minimum energy gap. So to understand the minimum energy gap, we can look at the energy spectrum, so the energy eigenstates, as a function of omega over delta, which is our energy of in terms of our spin flip, part of our Hamiltonian, over the cost function. And when our spin flip is off, then the energy of these states is just the size of basically the independent set. And as we turn this energy on, we'll basically split our levels. And the lowest two levels from the MIS, and in this case, the MIS minus one manifold, will come down and undergo an avoided crossing that corresponds to our minimum energy gap. And what this means is that we can really understand what's going on here using perturbation theory if this gap closing location, omega over delta star, is much less than one, which we find in practice is supported by our data. So in particular, what we'll be aiming to do is use perturbation theory to understand the gap in terms of these states, which I'll call E and G, which are just estimations for the two states that are involved in this level crossing. In particular, G is going to be some superposition of optimal MIS states, and E is some superposition of MIS minus one states. And our gap will be decided by basically how strong we can connect these states under our Hamiltonian in this perturbative regime by kind of flipping spins to get from an MIS minus one state to an MIS state. And we can then find these states G and E by basically using perturbation theory to diagonalize the Hamiltonian at low order in perturbation theory, which ends up being just finding the ground states of an effective spin exchange Hamiltonian that comes from our flip-flop, from our spin-flip interactions. And what we find ultimately when we do this is that the gap behavior can really be distilled down to two distinct limits. So we find that when G and E, these states involved in the level crossing, are localized on certain independent sets, like a single MIS and a single MIS minus one, then the gap is exponentially small in the Hamming distance between those two states. So really, your behavior is determined by how far away are these two states in terms of spin flips. In the other limit, if these two states are delocalized, so uniform superpositions of MISs or MIS minus ones, then the gap is basically goes as the square root of the ratio of the degeneracy of the MIS to the degeneracy of the MIS minus one state. And the reason we get this square root is basically due to coherent enhancement of this coupling between these two states. One way you could think of it is kind of like a W state for those that are familiar. And so what we get is from this predicted adiabatic gap that the runtime of an optimized quantum algorithm will just go as 1 over the gap, which goes like the square root of this degeneracy ratio, whereas the SA runtime will be linear in this degeneracy ratio, indicating that if we're running an optimized quantum adiabatic algorithm, we'll have a Grover type or quadratic speedup over SA to find the MIS. And the kind of intuition for those who are familiar with Grover search is that you're essentially searching among these suboptimal solutions for an optimal solution, where we know quantum algorithms can have a speed up. So which of these two limits are we really in? We can now kind of characterize this. And I'll just start by an example. So let's say that we have a star graph. So this is a graph with B branches connected in the middle by a single node, and each branch is length L. So here's B equals 6, L equals 2. This graph has a unique MIS with the central node in the independent set, and then basically alternating nodes on each branch. Now, E is some superposition for this case of MIS minus one states. And there are exponentially many MIS minus one states, just as in the case we saw before, where you have this lots of suboptimal solutions. And they basically correspond to having the central node out of the independent set and then a single domain wall that can kind of hop around on each branch. So there's exponentially many domain wall locations in the anti-ferromagnetic ordering, and those will correspond to our suboptimal independent sets. We can then estimate E perturbatively by minimizing the driver Hamiltonian at second order in perturbation theory, which is a spin exchange hopping type term. And we find that similar to kind of hopping model in 1D, that the domain wall will favor occupying the middle of the branch. So if our branch is very long, we'll kind of localize with this single domain wall here in the middle. And what this means is that when our branch length is very long, we'll again localize on these independent set configurations with the domain wall near the middle of the branch. But if our branch length is 2, as in the case I show here on the left, you're kind of equally favor both domain wall locations. So you're really delocalized in this case among all your suboptimal solutions. And you can see that here on this configuration graph, where here again, nodes are representing independent sets. So from our theoretical predictions, we would expect this delocalized case to have a quadratic speedup over simulated annealing. And indeed, if we plot the quantum runtime, so 1 over the gap, versus the SA hardest parameter, we find that for the L equals 2 case, we have a nice quadratic speedup over SA in finding the solution. However, as we increase L, we become more and more localized on these suboptimal configurations with the domain wall in the center of the branch. And what we find is that as we increase this branch length more and more, we get more and more localized, and we actually predict in the L goes to infinity limit that we have a quantum slowdown over SA. So localization here in this case is really bad because we're localizing at configurations that are very far away from the MIS. So going now back to the experiment, we are studying these disordered unit disk graph instances with a large SA hardness parameter, and we can do the same kind of analysis. So here again, plotting S quantum runtime versus hardness parameter. And I'm coloring the data points with how localized E is for that particular instance. And what we see is that on the instances that are most delocalized, we have a near quadratic speedup. These are these darker points. But on the localized instances, we perform worse than classical if we're localized at Hamming distances very far away from the solution. And on the instances that often do better than the simulated annealing algorithm, we localize very close to the solution, as predicted. So we've seen that quantum performance is highly dependent on the problem instance. And so one thing that we then asked is there a way to more generically guarantee a quadratic Grover-type speedup? And the way that we can do this is basically by forcing G and E to be uniform delocalized superpositions of MIS and MIS minus one states. And so we'll do this in practice by adding a strong delocalizing Hamiltonian with some strength whose ground states are uniform superpositions. And the idea will be if we work in the ground subspace roughly of this Hamiltonian, we will effectively restrict our dynamics to these delocalized states. And the way that we design this Hamiltonian in practice is we take inspiration from single particle quantum mechanics, where the kinetic energy operator just will promote delocalization. And it ends up being that this kinetic energy operator is a continuous Laplacian. So for this discrete combinatorial optimization problem, we'll make our delocalized Hamiltonian a Laplacian kind of in spin configuration space. And for our problem, it ends up being possible to do this with a simple spin exchange term plus a diagonal energy shift that comes from kind of normalizing this spin exchange term into a true kinetic energy operator. And notice that this is a local Hamiltonian with no sign problem, and we can still kind of construct this effective kinetic energy operator for our particular class of graphs. Then we'll turn on the strength of this Hamiltonian to something large. In practice, for the class of graphs we look at, it only needs to be polynomially large in the system size to restrict, again, to these uniform superposition states. And what we find is that when we turn on this driver Hamiltonian, the coupling between these uniform superposition states is coherently enhanced, so it goes like the square root of this degeneracy ratio. And this is really nice because then we can predict that our minimum energy gap should really go as the smallest coupling between two independent set sizes. And indeed, we are able to analytically argue that the gap really goes at the smallest coupling under motivated assumptions about our energy landscape, which gives us an effective quadratic speedup on this problem. And indeed, when we look at random instances of the disordered problem, we find that the quantum runtime versus the SA runtime is roughly quadratically better, which is coming from, again, this coherent Grover-type speedup. And since then, I've been working on, I guess, generalizing this bound on simulated annealing to both parallel tempering algorithms as well as quantum Monte Carlo algorithms. So as a summary, we've shown how a modification of the quantum adiabatic algorithm can provide a quadratic speedup. And this came from a framework that I introduced to understand the instance-by-instance performance variation in the standard adiabatic algorithm. And the key factor here was really the localization or delocalization of the states that were involved in the minimum gap level crossing. And I think as an outlook, there's a few interesting directions. One would be to kind of generalize these results possibly to rugged energy landscapes, if possible. Here we really focused on very flat energy landscapes where you have many local minima all of kind of the same energy that could be connected basically by a local SA updates. And these classes of instances with rugged energy landscapes have some really particular subclasses. So for instance, instances with what's called the overlap gap property that are hard to optimize for all local classical and often believed quantum algorithms. And then another work that I found really interesting is this work by Matt Hastings, as well as others, that shows how to get a super polynomial speedup with an adiabatic algorithm under an unphysical Hamiltonian by engineering very kind of ordered instances designed to, make classical algorithms get stuck in suboptimal solutions. So it'd be really interesting if you can use some of the analysis tools that I've worked on to kind of try and understand these results outside of the black box setting and maybe look for some speed up that's super polynomial over, for instance, simulated annealing as well. So with that, I'd like to acknowledge a very large group of people without which this work would never have been possible. Up top is the experimentalists of the Adam Ray team that took all the data and really made the experimental work what it was. In particular, my co-first author, Sepper, was really a great leader in this project. Also my theoretical collaborators, particularly the ones that I worked on with the speedup project, Ryan Sambuda, as well as Jingguo over here, who's at Quera and now is a professor in China. As well as my PI collaborators, my advisor, Misha, and as well as my theoretical PI collaborators as well. So yeah, I'm happy to take any final questions.
Thanks, Maddie. You mentioned the experiment has a coherence time.
Yeah.
Tell us what that is. Top of your head.
Yeah, so in real numbers, it's a few microseconds. But if you kind of, for theorists, if you normalize this to like the Hamiltonian energy scale that's associated with flipping a single spin for us, it corresponds to a circuit depth of about 32.
Cool. So you said that. Like you can't implement Grover's. That was on one of your first slides. Or there's like not an efficient implementation.
Yes.
But then you also mentioned that this is kind of like a special case of Grover's. So do you
yes.
see an extension like from this work towards kind of the more general search problem?
That's a really great question and a really important point that I maybe should have emphasized a little more. So Grover's search is basically searching for a single, you can think of it as like searching for a single bit string of n bits among 2 to the n possible bits. And often, you know, it's thought of as an Oracle problem where you really aren't working with a physical like Hamiltonian to find that state. And in practice, it requires like very high circuit depths because it requires a circuit depth of like square root 2 to the n. This is a little different because we're not getting a speed up over black box search, which Grover is looking at, but rather a speed up over classical algorithms. But it still, you're right, has the same elements of Grover search, where we are kind of coherently enhancing our search among many states that look the same to some better states that we're looking for. And the reason that we can do this using kind of like local Hamiltonians and interactions is very somewhat specific to the problem instance that I look at. And it's basically because we can engineer this kinetic energy operator that will delocalize us very efficiently. So it is somewhat problem specific, but it would be interesting to know how much it can be generalized to like other combinatorial optimization. Does that answer?
Okay,
cool.
Wow. You were serious, huh? About throw. Thanks for a great talk. This idea of delocalization, mm-hmm. To essentially, you know, aid you in your problem. Do you think this is an idea in terms of finding or achieving quantum speed up to find the ground state of some Hamiltonian? Mm-hmm. Is that something that you think can be applied to other problems? Just this idea of, you know, in other problems, if the ground states are more delocalized, would that, yeah, somehow, you know, enhance the ability of a quantum algorithm to scale better than a classical one?
Absolutely. I would say delocalization is kind of an inherent feature you need for Grover-type speedups. And in practice, this algorithm I mentioned where you kind of add this delocalizing Hamiltonian should work for any combinatorial optimization problem where basically the connectivity between these suboptimal solutions is the like kind of technical term is like a good expander. So you can easily kind of explore configuration space and get this delocalization. And this is likely not just limited to unit disk graphs, it's just the graphs that we looked at because we were motivated by the experiment.
Interesting, thank you. Yeah.
Awesome, sorry, thanks Maddie. I have a quick question about the classical optimization step when you're changing this Hamiltonian. When you have this delocalizing term, does that also get classically optimized?
So that would be a static Hamiltonian that just stays on the whole time. Okay. And the key thing is that you just want to really try and restrict your dynamics among these delocalized states.
Awesome, thank you.
Maybe a sort of follow-up. So when you do simulated annealing,
you're
not actually, I think I asked you this before, you're not actually annealing in a parameter, right? In simulated annealing, I usually imagine is you anneal in the temperature, the classical version of the temperature. Does that change your kind of bounds at all if you do a...
No. So that's a really good question. So there are kind of two things here. One is that you can make these analytic bounds at any temperature or any sufficiently low temperature where you can actually prepare the maximum independent set. So really it doesn't matter kind of what temperature you're annealing at because the best thing that you can do is kind of evolve at a long time at the temperature corresponding to like this biggest bottleneck point. And for us, that bottleneck exists at really any temperature. But also in practice, my SA implementation doesn't change the temperature. And that's just because I have an update move that's ergodic enough to where I never really even need to raise the energy during the evolution because I'm using like a cluster-based update. So. Yeah, it's not really annealing in that sense, but I was really trying to optimize simulated annealing, so that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. You ready, Mario?
Stressing me out.
Hi. Yes, Alex, thanks. Very cool talk. So I'm not from this field, so my question is probably very naive.
No, don't worry.
This is for near-term devices, right? Those algorithms are basically near-term algorithms.
Yes.
What is the connection then if you look 15, 20 years in the future when we have those error-corrected quantum computers? Is there still something that you can use the insights from here to those future computers?
Okay, this is a really good question, and I think that it's a good point to kind of plug work that I think is more interesting than mine, which is people have generalized getting a Grover-type speedup over any classical Markov chain algorithm. So that's actually a known result, and it requires quantum phase estimation, I think also amplitude amplification, so it's really not a near-term algorithm, but it's still very, very interesting. And so I think, you know, if one day we had quantum computers that were just as good as classical computers, that would be a really interesting application. That said, of course, there is some doubt as to whether polynomial speedups will really be useful, you know, decades in the future, just because it's very hard to engineer these quantum systems. And I would say that's a very open question, but I'm an optimist.
Thanks.
Maddie, what excites you the most about the Rydberg platform? And just to put you on the spot, and you know, what do you perceive as its sort of pros and cons going forward?
Yeah, I have lots of thoughts on this because I am really lucky. I get to work closely with the experimentalists, and what they're doing is super, really, really interesting to me. I think really big pro about this platform is that it's really easy to scale up. So this work showed up to about 289 qubits, I think it was. Right now, upgrades are underway for getting around 1,000 qubits, which is just on a different scale than a lot of other platforms. And I think that it's reasonable to increase the gate fidelities a reasonable amount to where we can actually think about doing small demonstrations of error correction as well as like small demonstrations of logical qubit algorithms just because we have so access to so many physical qubits. So I think as a quantum computing platform, it's actually kind of a dark horse and very interesting.
This is just related to the Rydberg thing, but I just have never really gotten a clear explanation. What does it mean to be hardware efficient?
Yeah, so that's a great question. When I think about hardware efficient, I think that it doesn't require a lot of, if we're thinking about non-error corrected computation, it doesn't require a lot more physical qubit than there kind of are degrees of freedom in your problem. So you don't need like a lot of extra in silico qubits that are helping your computation along. So for us, we only have a qubit representing a node in the graph that we want to solve. So it's literally like a one-to-one mapping. And if we had some, I mean, like people are focusing on combinatorial optimization for other problems, but it typically requires like a lot of compilation, and they can really only go up to much smaller system sizes of like tens of qubits. So I think it's really important to have like co-design in mind when you think about algorithms.
Hey, so thanks for the talk. So at one point, I think you mentioned that the MIS ground state probability increases, like when you like sweep slowly at particular energy gaps, right? So this just seems to be a bit similar to what current D-wave annealers do. Like, yeah, like if you basically decrease the transverse field slowly at some points at the anneal, your ground state probability increases. So is it something similar to that?
That's interesting. So our device tends to have a lot more coherence than the D-Wave devices, so I would say that's a pretty key difference. Obviously, we do have noise, so we're not staying perfectly in the many-body ground state during the adiabatic evolution, but I think during this work, we were pretty convinced by the fact that we had such a strong correlation between the many-body gap and the MIS probability that we really do think that we are in some sort of gap limited regime.
So I have a little follow-up question. Very nice talk, by the way. So you said that the gap is depending on the distance, Hamming distance between the ground state and the first excited state. Do you know how that distance scales with the system size?
That's a great question. So the answer is that in the worst case, the Hamming distance will scale exponentially in the system size. So you will have exponentially small spectral gaps. And there are some really kind of pathological worst case instances where you actually scale super exponential in an exponent that is worse than the system size even, because the gap closing location actually is very late, which makes the gap even smaller. But there's a huge variation even within a given system size. So you can find, I can find graph instances of any system size that have very, very large gap and very, very small Hamming distance. So it really is, you kind of need like a finer metric, which is why we looked to identify this Hamming distance is what was really going on. We really need a finer metric, I guess, than just system size on its own.
I see. And a quick follow-up question. So on the Hamiltonian that you added, that is similar to kind of the kinetic term in the continuous case, you mentioned that it is sign-free, but
yes.
I think it doesn't need to be sign-free, sign problematic free on the platform. Was it related to comparing with quantum Monte Carlo that you choose a sign-free?
I didn't hear the last part of your question. Were you asking, so the Hamiltonian I add doesn't have a sign problem, and you were asking about quantum Monte Carlo?
No, so I guess for you to simulate it on the ReadBird platform, whether it's sign-free or not, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But it should matter if you want to simulate it with quantum Monte Carlo. Was yes. the reason why you chose that?
Yeah, so that was actually a really interesting, that was a question I thought was really interesting too. So I basically used the same techniques as simulated annealing to also gain a partial speedup over quantum Monte Carlo, but not full quadratic, despite, you know, it being a sign-free Hamiltonian. And this really comes from the fact that we have a coherent enhancement that you simply can't get if you're kind of exploring these suboptimal solutions as a mixed state, which you are with quantum Monte Carlo.
I just follow up on Estelle's first question. So can you just kind of explain for the novice, what's the consequence of the gap scaling as a function of system size, which I think is rough?
Yeah, so the what this means is that without error correct, so if the gap scales poorly with system size, you'll need to run your algorithm for longer and longer to find the solution as you scale up the problem size. And so what this means is without error correction, we're really limited in the problem sizes that we can solve within our coherence time, because there is some kind of upper bound on how long we can really evolve our system coherently due to that many body noise. So I think it's a good motivation for trying to develop error correction in these platforms.
And so one thing I didn't fully understand, so isn't the runtime proportional to 1 over the gap squared in the adiabatic theorem?
Yes, so the runtime is proportional generally to 1 over the gap squared. However, it's known that if you slow down your evolution at that point of the minimum gap closing, for instance, this is known for the adiabatic version of Grover search, then the best case you can get for an optimized adiabatic algorithm is a scaling that goes like 1 over the gap. And this is really necessary to kind of get a quadratic speed up, is this optimization.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Last chance. Semmel, you're looking at me. Do you have another question? No? Last chance, everyone. Let me take a peek online here. Any hand raises? I think, Mario.
Yeah, this is not directly on your talk, but on the platform again. Uh-huh. You said you have a much higher coherence than other systems. One way to measure this would be to create a very large tiered set state and see uh-huh. how many particle you can do. And I think the ION platform has 24, mm-hmm. if I remember right. What is it that you could create?
So the last time we tried to do this was, I think, before I was a grad student. So maybe in like 2017 or 2018. And I think then they had around 20 qubits. But since then, the platform has developed quite a lot. So I would expect that number to be higher. Mm-hmm.
And I cannot remember whether there was something published beyond 20. I think I didn't add anything. So if you have something.
Nothing new is published beyond that first paper, I think. Yeah, we were in talks with the experimentalists to see if we could do it, because we can put a lot of atoms in two dimensions and make a 2D GHZ state. But they're in upgrades right now, so they haven't tried it.
Cool, thanks.
Thanks, Mario. Yep.
Thank you all.
I think it's time for coffee break. Let's give Maddie a warm round of applause for a wonderful talk.